So with the invitation of the Sangha here this evening at Bodhinyana Monastery, I'm very pleased to be able to give this Wednesday night talk on the day before the performance of the first bhikkhuni ordination at Bodhinyana, first Theravadan bhikkhuni ordination in Australia, and the first bhikkhuni ordination in the forest tradition anywhere in the world. So this is something which is an outcome of, as you all know, of many years of work on my part personally, and of course of countless others. And I can't begin to list or acknowledge all of the people who have helped and led to this, but I would like to start, before I start my talk proper this evening, I'd just like to start by mentioning a few people and incidences which come to mind, which I'd like to express a special gratitude for my own personal development in understanding how we should relate and understand to women in the holy life. And so the people I'd like to mention and the things I'd like to mention for this evening, first of all, my first monastic teacher, Sajjan Pasano, was a monk who always had a great kindness for women, and would never hear any kind of slight or negative comment about women, and made sure that women would always be included in the monastery activities. For example, we would take the 10 precept nun Sanghamita on Pindavata with us, with the monks when we would go for alms round. Second person I'd like to state to mention would be his successor at Nanachat was Ajahn Jayasara. And Ajahn Jaya also was somebody who was very kind in his relationship with women. And there's one particular episode that I mentioned, that I remember, which was there was a book published in America by a woman on, can't remember who it was, something about women in Buddhism. And she had, as part of the research for that book, she had interviewed Ajahn Jayasara. And he had said something along the lines of, if I remember it correctly, that part of one's spiritual development and becoming a mature monk was learning to be able to relate to women in a mature spiritual way. I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was something along those lines. And Ajahn Jayasara was very embarrassed because she quoted him saying this, and then she compared him to the behaviour, I believe it was, of Anuruddha, when he was invited to the house. I don't know if you remember the episode from the Vinaya where he was staying overnight in the house, and the woman innkeeper tried to seduce him, and he sort of rejected her quite sternly. I believe it was that episode, but the author of the book compared Ajahn Jayasara's attitude towards women quite favourably, and criticising Anuruddha's comparative lack of understanding and compassion. So poor old Ajahn Jayasara was a little bit embarrassed by that little episode. Third person I'd like to mention specially would be Ajahn Chandako. When I was a young monk, Ajahn Chandako was my mentor, and we were very close. And he several times I remember him especially mentioning the good practice of some of the Mechi and the nuns in Thailand. He told me the story of Mechi Gao, a renowned meditation master, student of Ajahn Mun. And a number of occasions he made a special point to mention that, these kinds of things. So I remember him as being a role model in supporting and promoting the spiritual practice of women. And the last one I'd like to mention, and possibly the most important of all, is Ajahn Nyanadhammo. And when we were staying here in Bodhinyana together, as it happens, Ajahn Nyana and I have sisters, both have sisters who are about the same age. Many of you probably met Ajahn Nyana's sister, a lovely woman. And also Ajahn Nyana and myself both have very good relations with our sisters. And there was one time when I remember he made a comment to me and I can't remember exactly the comment, but it was something along the lines that when we're born or when we're young, the kind of the most important people in our lives are our parents. But as we grow older, the parents become more distant. Eventually, usually our parents die and we live out the last part of our life without our parents. But our brothers and sisters are people who will be there for the whole of our life, and that they're someone who we share everything with, from childhood through to growing up, adolescence, maturity, and then aging and so on. And they share all of those life experiences with us. And so in many ways is the most important relationship that we have in our life. And so I remember that. I always remember that. It was very insightful and quite an important statement for me. One of the pivotal things in my own personal relationship to bhikkhuni ordination was a very small conversation I had with my own sister here in Bodhinyala one day. She came to visit me to offer dana, and we had a chat after the meal. And she said very, very gently and non-judgmentally, she said that she found it difficult to fully commit herself or be interested in any religious practice of any religion because none of them gave a fair go to women. And I thought that was, I was quite moved by that, and I thought there was something wrong here. If what's wrong with Buddhism, if my sister can't practice the Dhamma or can't feel welcomed and supported in that practice in the same way that I do. And so this is one of those things that began to alert me to the fact that there was something quite wrong in Buddhism and something that we need to do to change this. And it occurs to me that as monks, when we have an idea or relationship with women, that we have, there are actually several role models for this. So the most obvious one is that we relate to women as a mother. So all of the wonderful women who come to offer dana and to look after and care for the monks in a very motherly way. We also can relate to women as a daughter, when we have students who come and they need teaching and guidance, and we can relate to them in that way. We also relate to women as a lover. Yeah? And so this is the temptress or the danger, the threat that's perceived to the holy life, and we can see that. But where is it, or how can we relate to women as a sister? It seems to me that this very important, perhaps most important of all ways of relating to the feminine, is lacking or is absent, has fallen away in contemporary Theravada Buddhism, and I think this is a great shame. When we look at the framework of the sasana as it was established by the Buddha himself, as we all know, the overarching structure that he talked about for the Buddhist community was always the fourfold community, the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen and laywomen. And this is, of course, a balanced structure, and that balanced structure is not just found in that particular form, but everywhere we look, we find that, for example, we have like a bhikkhu Sanyutta, we also have a bhikkhuni Sanyutta, we have a bhikkhu Patimokkha and also a bhikkhuni Patimokkha, we have the Thera Gatha and also the Theri Gatha. And so it seems to me that if we look at the overall big picture of the structures within original Buddhism, that this was all very balanced. So I'm not trying to make the much more complicated argument about whether all the details are balanced. That's a much more complicated matter. But in terms of the big picture, the overall structures, I don't think there's any doubt that there is this balance. Now, if we consider this notion of the fourfold assembly, in one sense, the fourfold assembly is an external classification or structure of the Buddhist community, and in that sense, each one of us belongs to one or other of those four groups or four assemblies. We're either bhikkhu or bhikkhuni or laymen or laywomen. Of course, there's always some boundary issues, for example, with samaneras and samaneris and so on. But pretty much we belong to one or other of these four groups. But there's another aspect or another dimension of these four groups, and that's not as a social classification system, but as an idea in our minds. And so for each of the people sitting here this evening, we have an idea of these fourfold assembly. And in that idea of the fourfold assembly, we don't necessarily belong so clearly to one or other of them. But if we look at those different kinds of persons, we can see that they may be associated with different, perhaps different qualities or different kinds of activities or something like that, and that we have all of those. So, for example, just as a couple of very simple examples of what I mean here, is that, for example, the idea of a lay man, an upasika. Yeah, so a lay man is somebody, for example, has a role in Buddhism of providing physical support for the Sangha, just as a simple example. But we also do that, don't we? We do work like, say, building work, which might be felt to be also a lay person's job. And so there's a boundary, there's not clear-cut boundaries between that. Similarly with a lay woman's job, so bhikkhus will do work which might be considered also characteristic of a lay woman's activities, such as, for example, caring for each other when we're ill and adopting that role as a nurse and a nurturing role, like a motherly role. And similarly with the bhikkhus and bhikkhuni. So we have all of those things within us. They're all a part of us. And we don't so much belong to one or other of those groups. We orientate ourselves among them. And so we exist and we negotiate a relationship with all of those four groups. And so if we think of the fourfold assembly in this way, then it becomes immediately apparent that when the bhikkhuni sangha is absent, that there's something broken, there's something unbalanced. Not just unbalanced in terms of a external community, but unbalanced within our own minds. There's a lack there. That spiritual dimension of womanhood, of femininity, whatever that means, not something we can define or pin down, but whatever that means, that's lacking. And so our ability to relate to that spiritual dimension of femininity is lost or is diminished. And I think this is very sad. Now, over the years, as I've been contemplating these things and researching and studying them, I've been, it's been an important thing for me. It's been an important part of my spiritual development, not just as a political act to try to get the Bhikkhuni Sangha established, but also to try to work with my own mind and understand my own issues and problems around understanding women and how I relate to them and so on. And of course, this is always an ongoing question, but it's something that I think we need to consider quite carefully. And it's not something which I believe that we get very much clear or explicit guidance from, particularly in the suttas, perhaps. Maybe, maybe not. Might be something worth considering, more research in that area, and certainly in the Dhamma as it's often presented these days. And so I've had to sort of look around and try to nut out for myself what these things might mean. Now, I'm going to beg for your indulgence now, because I'm going to introduce a little bit of psychological jargon, and I know that Bodhinyana is notoriously not a psychology-friendly monastery. So if you want to just bag me after this talk and say Sujata's gone all psychobabble, then that's, you're most welcome to do that. But these are just some ideas from Jungian psychology which I found very useful and which have helped me to understand these things. So I'll just explain these ideas briefly and then I'll try to use them to analyse some Jataka stories and try to show how they work in terms of personal development. So these concepts that I want to talk about, the first concept is the concept of the anima and the animus. Very basic concept in Jungian psychology. What it means is that in the mind of every man there is somehow an image of the feminine side of himself, which is called the anima. And the anima is most closely related to the idea of a sister. So the anima is a partner and a companion who one goes through one's life and has adventures and learns and grows with. So a great example of the anima figure would be the relationship between Luke Skywalker and Leia in Star Wars. That's a classic anima relationship. And of course for women have the opposite. They have the animus figure, is an idea of a masculine part of their own psyche, which figures as an idea in their own minds. So according to Jungian psychology, these figures appear to us in our dreams, but they're also things which are represented in various ways in stories, fables and myths. So this is one idea that I'd like to bring up for you. Another idea is just like an analytical concept. If we think of the masculine and feminine sides of ourselves, of our own minds, that's in need of further refining, because femininity and masculinity are not unified or simple things. And Jung and especially his follower Neumann used the idea of the higher masculine and lower masculine, the higher feminine and lower feminine. So it's this division into the higher and lower. The idea of the higher and lower is not an actual thing. There's no particular qualities which are higher masculine or lower masculine or something like that. What it really means is that what is higher is something which is to be aspired to. So in Buddhist terms you'd say bhavetabha, to be developed. And what is lower is something which is to be abandoned, pahatabha. These things are not, this is not things that are good or bad. It's just things which are appropriate or inappropriate at a certain stage of development. So that's just all very abstract. And I'll explain in more detail what I mean later on. But just a simple example of what that might mean. For example, for a woman's development at a certain stage in her life, maybe a woman becomes a mother. And so at that point, her maternal bonding and love for her child is a higher development. It means a calling out of greater compassion and greater giving on her part to sacrifice so much time and love for this other being that she's given birth to. So at that point, her maternal love is the higher feminine, and her abandoning of her perhaps girlish irresponsibility is abandoning the lower feminine. But at a later point in her life, when her child has grown up, that maternal love becomes then the lower feminine. That becomes something she has to abandon, her attachment to her child, and to allow them to grow up and find their own life. So this is just a simple example to show how what that kind of thing I mean with these qualities, and that they're not things which are either good nor bad, but things which represent certain stages of development. Now these kinds of ideas that I've been thinking about are not things which I've found to be discussed explicitly in the suttas. But what I've noticed is that when I've been rereading the Buddhist Jataka stories, is that there's many tales which seem to reflect or embody these kinds of ideas in quite interesting ways. And one of the... what are the Jataka stories? Of course, the Jataka stories are supposed to be the past life stories of the Buddha before he's born in this life. I mean, of course, most of them aren't genuine past life memories. But what they are, in a sense, is that they're in a more real sense, is that they are stories which the Buddhist community has told to itself in order to explain and to make vivid the notion of spiritual development, remembering that each one of the Jataka stories is in some sense leading up to the attainment of enlightenment. So none of the Jatakas and none of the stories and ideas within there are in any sense transcendental. Okay, they don't deal with the profound Dhamma of Nibbana and transcendence. Okay, they deal with much more fundamental matters of personality development and character development, which are gradually leading up to the attainment of those higher Dhammas. And so it seems to me that we can find a lot of interesting information in there and ideas about how the Buddhist community has seen and understood these things within its own Indian cultural context. Now, when I was recently rereading these stories, I noticed a particular type of story, a pattern of story, which was repeated again and again. I counted about 15 or 20 different episodes or occasions where this particular pattern was found in very different stories in very different places, but with all some specific and easily identifiable features which were in common. And I think this particular archetype or pattern is a very interesting one to understand the notion of femininity and masculinity and how development occurs within that context. And so what I'd like to do now is to tell a few of these stories and to give some kind of psychological explanation or reflection on them and give them some kind of context. And these stories occur at various different levels, from quite banal, simple levels of animal fables and so on, right the way up to quite exalted and high myth. And I'll start with one of the simplest versions of these stories, and this is a story of two crocodiles. So there's two crocodiles living in a river, a man and woman crocodile, or male, I don't know what you call them, male crocodile Edie, is it? A crocodile and his missus. And they're living quite happily in their river. Now all of a sudden, one day, the wife, the female crocodile, conceives this longing, this yearning. She says to her husband, "I have this longing." He says, "What is it, dear? What do you want?" And she says, I must eat the heart of a monkey." Right? He says, "But the heart of a monkey, that's not crocodile food, you know. We can't get monkeys, they're up on the trees and so on. They're not down here with us in the water. How am I supposed to get a crocodile heart?" She says, "I must have a crocodile heart. If I do not have one, I will lie here in the water until I die." So he says, "Okay, I'll try my best to get you a monkey heart. So he swims down the river. He sees a monkey playing in the trees on the side. And he thinks of a plan. He calls out to the monkey, "Hey, you there, monkey. I can see over there you're eating that old mango. But I tell you what, there's much better mango trees on the other side of the river. Why don't you just hop on my back and I'll take you across the river and then you can get a much better mango there." So the monkey thinks, "Oh, that sounds like a good idea." He jumps on the crocodile's back. The crocodile starts swimming down river to where his wife is. The monkey's thinking, "Where are you going?" He asks him, "What are you doing? You're not taking me across to the far shore." The crocodile says, "Are you stupid? Do you honestly think I was taking you to get more mangoes? We're going to rip your heart out and eat it." Monkey, of course, being quite clever, immediately said back to the crocodile, "Oh, really?" He says, "Well, I'm afraid I've got some bad news for you." The crocodile says, "What's that?" He said, "Well, you obviously don't know very much about monkeys, because we spent all our day jumping around the trees, and if we had our hearts in our chest, they'd just get knocked around all the time. So actually, we take them out every morning, and we keep them up in the tree. And then we jump around all day without our hearts, and then the evening before we go to sleep, we put the hearts back in. So if you want to eat my heart, then you'll have to put me back on the shore. I'll pop over and get it, and I'll come back and give it to you." The crocodile thinks, "Oh, that sounds like a good idea." So he toughs the monkey off. The monkey stands on the shore and says, "I can't believe how stupid that crocodile is." Have you ever heard of an animal that can keep its heart in a tree? And he runs off. The crocodile, of course, is very disappointed, and that's the end of that little story. I guess he got a tongue lashing from his missus when he got back. So there's a number of interesting features about that story. One feature is the role of the woman in that story, the crocodile. What does she do? What she does, one specific thing in that story, and that is she wishes. She longs, she yearns, she desires. That's all. She doesn't actually do anything. She just lies there, passive and still, and wants. Yeah? The men do all the action is done by the men. Yeah? The woman just lies there and longs. Now, of course, you know, if you read that on a surface level and reading that story, you think, well, that's probably fairly kind of typical, kind of smarmy, a slur on the kind of insatiability and irrationality of women's desires, isn't it? Yeah, they just want this kind of completely unreasonable thing, and say, I'm going to die here if you don't get it for me. And so that's one way that that story could be read. But perhaps there's more to it than that. If we look at the men in the story, you have the crocodile and the monkey, and it seems fairly obvious that here you have a kind of a lower and a higher kind of form of the masculine, which is being presented. The crocodile literally is low and literally spends most of his time underwater in the unconscious. The monkey is leaping up in the air and round the trees, active, vigorous, playful. So they're representing different kinds of masculine qualities. The crocodile is the killer, yeah? Whereas the monkey is the one who leaps in the air and in the trees. And the monkey, of course, is the one who has the intelligence, the cunning. So just considering those two men, then you could think in terms of that pattern that I was talking about before, that the crocodile may be like the lower masculine, the monkey the higher masculine, and perhaps one wonders whether in longing, in the woman's longing for this monkey, is that perhaps, could that be interpreted in a psychological sense as her longing for a higher masculine side of herself? This is just a suggestion here, but there's another version of this story which makes the suggestion much more clear, and that's a very long and late jataka called the Vidura Pandita Jataka. And that Vidura Pandita Jataka is not a simple folk fable like the last one. It's a very long and sophisticated story which I can't tell at all here, really just mention a few episodes, but it is a very interesting one. In particular, I just mention by the way that it has near the end of it, it has a rip-snorting critique of Brahmanism and theistic religion, which is perhaps the best one that I've ever read in a Buddhist text. So if you're interested in good arguments against the existence of God in a Buddhist text, then check out the Vidura Pandita Jataka. But in that, the main motivation for the action of this very long and complex story is a Naga princess. And this Naga princess hears of the reputation of this great sage, this wise minister called Vidura Pandita, who is the advisor to the king in the human realm. And she hears of his wisdom and so on. And she lies down where she is and she says, I must have his heart. Bring me the heart of the sage. I'm going to lie here and die until I get it, unless I get it. And she has this yearning and this longing. Now, one of the very interesting things about these stories is that the word that's used for the longing is very specific. It's the Pali word is dohala. Dohala. Now, those of you who know Pali will probably, like myself, never heard of the word dohala. It's actually derived from durhadaya, literally like bad heart or sad heart. And it's only found in this specific context. Sometimes dohala is associated with the cravings of a pregnant woman, but most of the time not. Most of the time it's like this kind of context here. A woman lies down, she has this dohala, this completely unstoppable desire, this wish. And so from this particular wish, can't go into all the details, but a very complex and quite entertaining story ensues, and at the end, near the end of it, the wise man himself, the sage, hears of this wish that they're trying to get him so that the princess can have his heart, and he says, take me to her. And they say, but she's going to rip your heart out. She said she wants your heart. And he says, sometimes words can have more than one meaning. So they take the sage to see her, and of course, as the text says, the heart of a sage is his wisdom. And so when the sage reaches the princess, he gives her a teaching on Dhamma, and all of the Nagas rejoice. So in that particular story, we've seen a very, very similar pattern. And it's clear that the heart here is not a physical heart, it's not a lump of meat, but it's the wisdom. The text says that quite explicitly. And it's quite clear that this is for that Naga princess, is her encounter with that higher masculine, that side of masculine side, which is speaking to her words of wisdom. There's yet another version of that same pattern in the Chadanta Jataka. And the Chadanta Jataka is another very interesting Jataka story, which I can't tell in detail. And I would just note as just a special little footnote here, I've been writing so many books with footnotes, I can't avoid putting it even in my Dhamma talks, but a little footnote aside here is one of the fascinating things is that the Chadanta Jataka includes a detailed description of mountaineering equipment and abseiling techniques. Okay, so this is quite possibly a first for Buddhism in world literature. I don't know of any description of abseiling techniques that comes earlier than this. So the Chadanta Jataka is something, very briefly, is the Bodhisattva is born as a magnificent royal white elephant with six tusks who lives in a very remote mountain range as the king of a herd of elephants. He has a number of wives. One of the wives gets jealous towards the other, the jealous one, and she conceives, she says she's going to kill the Bodhisattva. She dies, gets reborn as a queen. And she has again this yearning or this dohala. And the king sends for a hunter. The hunter is described in very coarse ways. He's thick-bodied with yellow teeth that stick out and he's very ugly and everything. And as a hunter is the killer, of course. So the killer is very clearly the lower masculine in this story and the royal, noble royal elephant is the higher masculine. Again, these very similar patterns. She has this wish. She doesn't do anything else. She just has this wish. The hunter goes, long story of his travels and climbing mountains and so on and so forth. Eventually he finds the elephant, traps it, and saws off its tusk. And it's a very poignant and sad telling of the story. The hunter, in fact, is Devadatta in a past life and brutally saws off the tusk, even though the elephant deliberately sacrifices his own life and bleeds to death in a painful and brutal way. And the tusk is taken back for the queen. And she is filled with sorrow when it comes because she remembers actually how much she loved the Bodhisattva. So this is another version of that story. This version strikes me as being particularly Christ-like. The sacrifice of the elephant was so much like Jesus on the cross. It's quite an extraordinary the emotional or the spiritual similarity is very extraordinary. But that, in the Buddhist context, is not a high or a successful form of the story. So notice in these different stories that there are different levels of success. The stories are pitched at different levels, some are higher and some are lower. But they're also, so they might succeed or not succeed. The first one, the crocodile just didn't get the monkey heart that she wanted. The second one, they actually got the heart of the sage and it was successful. And this one, the Chadanta Jataka, she kind of got what she wanted, but then she realized that that wasn't really what she wanted after all. So this, of course, is reflecting the realities of personal development as well, that sometimes we succeed, sometimes we fail, as we continue with all of these tasks. But the most important, and for my mind the most beautiful and profound versions of this particular pattern, is a cluster of tales which center around a mythical golden beast. And the golden beast might be a golden peacock, a golden deer, or a golden goose in different tellings of the tale, each one having its own particular details. But I'll focus mainly on the story of the golden peacock. This is in the Mora Jataka, and a few different versions of it in the Jatakas are all very similar. Now in this Mora Jataka and similar ones, we have the woman, is Queen Kema of Benares. And she hears a rumor of the golden peacock, or the golden deer, or whatever. And she immediately, this dohala arises, this insatiable, unstoppable yearning. She says, I must have him. She lies down and she says, I'm going to die right here unless I have him. And so the king, of course, very disturbed and agitated, and calls a gathering of hunters to go and search for the golden peacock. First of all, maybe he calls the Brahmins and says, have you ever heard of such a beast? Is there such a thing as a golden peacock? And they say, yes, we've heard of it in our lore and our legends, but nobody's ever seen one. The golden peacock doesn't live around here. It doesn't live near the haunts of man. It lives in seclusion in the wilderness, in far off places. No man has seen them for such a long time. But yet they might exist. And so they find an especially brave hunter who's willing to go and find this golden peacock. And he sets out. And the journey is long. He, of course, crosses the uncrossable river, penetrates the impenetrable forest, climbs the unclimbable mountains. In some versions of the story, Queen Kema dies and they still haven't found the peacock. Some versions, 7 lifetimes go, the legend is passed down from generation to generation, and still the search goes on until finally the peacock is found. And so this is, of course, an analogue or a metaphor for the the difficulty of our own personal development and ability to surmount the challenges that lie ahead of us in our lives. And the peacock really, really, really does not want to be found. He's gone as far away as he can. He realizes that being near men is dangerous. And he wants to find a place of safety. So he goes to the most remote mountains, to a cave in a high, inaccessible place. Eventually the hunter reaches him, the killer. Goes to where the cave is, sees the peacock. In the dawn, the peacock comes out, and in the golden glow of the dawn, the peacock spreads his golden feathers and sings a verse. The verse he sings is in praise of the sun. Visioned one, Chakuma, I can't remember the verse altogether, but it says, one word that sticks in my mind from this, he calls the sun Eka Raja. The sun is called the One King. The verse there is very Vedic sounding. It reminds me very much of the Gayatri mantra, which is the most well known of the Vedic mantras recited in India to this day every morning. The Gayatri mantra is Tatsavitur Varenyam Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi Dhyoyo Naha Prachodayat, which means homage to that glorious rising sun whose divine radiance is inspirational and who impels our consciousness to awakening. Something like that is the translation. So I find that quite a beautiful verse, you know, reflection on the time of dawn, waking up on a literal sense. Of course, we wake up at dawn when the sun rises, and in a spiritual sense, of course, is a symbol for the enlightened mind. Now, this Vedic style verse recited in the Mora Parita by the golden peacock, and quite crudely and obviously, followed by a Buddhist verse in praise of the arahants and so on, which is kind of tacked on afterwards to kind of render a superficial Buddhisticness to the tale, but it's got not really anything to do with the actual story. So of course if you think that image, try to imagine in your mind that golden peacock, the beautiful golden feathers, the light of the morning sun, and peacock spreading those feathers and being lit up in the morning sun, and how it would, that peacock in itself is almost the image of the rising sun itself. And peacock is clearly a solar symbol, a symbol of the sun. And this is also made clear in other tellings of the story, for example, with the geese who fly to outrun the sun and things like that. And so this the golden peacock is a very pure, quintessentially pure symbol of the higher masculine in a very refined and very kind of glorious form. And each day he sings this verse and goes off and then comes in the evening and sings the verse and returns. And the hunter approaches the peacock, intending to kill him. But when the hunter comes near the peacock and sees his glory and his beauty and his nobility, he finds himself unable to follow through with that act. And this is really the turning point in this story. And I really love this particular tale because it shows this development in almost the most almost the perfect outline. It's at that moment that the hunter approaches the peacock. He wants to kill him, but he can't. Yeah. He can't. Not like the Chadanta story where he brutally saws off the tusk. The Buddhist version of the story, at that moment, compassion arises in his heart for this beast. Remember, this is a hunter. This is a killer. His life has been spent in cold-hearted and brutal pursuit of beings to kill and slaughter and maim. That's what he does. That's what the hunter is. And when he confronts this higher solar masculine figure, his perfection, he cannot go through with that. His lower nature is sublimated. Compassion arises in his heart. He's not a hunter anymore. He's not a killer anymore. And he has tears in his eyes. He falls down before the peacock. He says, I've come here to kill you, but I can't go through with it. I know that when I return to the palace, the king will kill me because I failed in my task. But there's nothing I can do. I can't bring myself to kill you. So this is a magnificent transformational moment here, where that lower part of the hunter's masculinity has been transformed. Now, notice what's happening here. We have this peacock, this perfect image of that masculine in seclusion and isolation, cut off from everything, protected from everything, run away from the whole world, run away from the depredations of mankind, from the foresters and the hunters, and finding seclusion with no one else around. Does that perhaps sound a little bit familiar? That's us, isn't it? That's what we do, we monks. Or at least what we try to do. Or we long to do, we want to do. We have this idea in our mind. That's an ideal monk's life, isn't it? To go to a hill in the Himalayas, find a cave, and just stay there with nobody else around in glorious isolation. And this is very much a powerful idea behind the idea of a Buddhist monk, a rishi and a sage. And that's a very successful strategy. That peacock has escaped from the haunts of man, he's found a place where he can live and stay there for a long time, very successfully. But he's gone there out of fear. He's gone to that place out of fear. And when he's gone to that place out of fear, there is one thing that you know must always happen. And that is that the hunter will always find him. No matter how far he goes, no matter how well protected he is, the hunter will always get there in the end. And so that place of seclusion, no matter how far and secluded you are, is never a total or permanent place of safety. But in this story, because this is a successful story, this is not a failure, this is a success, the hunter is transformed. That danger is gone. The threat has disappeared. And when the hunter says to the peacock, "I'll return to the palace, you stay here, I'll return to the palace and you live your life," the peacock says, "No, take me with you. We'll go to the palace together." The hunter says, "No, he can't do that. They'll kill you." His queen has a longing. She's going to kill you. And the peacock says, "Don't worry about that. We go together." Now, this is also a very important moment or important juncture, which actually features in a lot of Jataka stories in different senses. There's a typical kind of story would be run something like this, that you'd have an ascetic lives as a rishi in the Himalayas. He comes down to the city in search of alms food. The king sees him, is very impressed by his demeanor, and invites him to stay in a hut in the palace grounds. The ascetic sets up in there, and each day he sits in the hut in jhanas. In the morning he will fly through the air with his psychic powers to the top of the palace, where he will meet the king and queen, and they will offer dana. And somebody today asked for a talk dealing with psychic powers, so there I managed to slip a little bit of psychic powers in there for you. And he gets his alms and then flies with his psychic powers back to his hut. One day the king has some business to do, he's away, and the monk flies up to the palace, top of the palace, and the queen is there to offer the dana. And as she's offering the dana into his bowl, her robe slips. And as her robe slips and he sees her, the defilements that have lain dormant in his mind for such a long time rear up again like a cobra rearing its head. And he thinks, well, he says to the queen, he says, "I think I'll have to use the stairs today." Immediately his psychic powers have disappeared, and somewhat embarrassed he rushes down the stairs and goes back to his hut. So again, you can see here's the encounter of the higher masculine figure, the ascetic figure, who encounters with the lower feminine figure, yeah, the woman as an object of sexual desire. And then that, of course, causes the decline, the deterioration. So these things can all go in so many different ways. And so in that sense, that woman was a threat to him, a danger, and caused his falling away from his holy life. So when the peacock says, "I'm going to go back to the palace and see the queen," there's a genuine danger there. This is not something which is benign or risk-free. There's a very genuine danger. As a figure of the higher masculinity, he's taking a risk to get himself re-entrapped. Anyway, they go. They see Princess Kama. Queen Kama. I wonder if there might be some significance to her name. Kama. Kama means safety. It means security. Curiously enough, all of the different versions of this story that have this very kind of high level of this story, she's always called Kama, is safety. And so our peacock, who has gone to the furthest reaches of the land to seek safety in isolation and seclusion, now comes back into the palace, the heart of the city, the heart of worldly existence, and there he finds Kama. And when the peacock arrives, he gives a Dhamma talk to the queen and to the king and to the palace. And they're so thrilled and inspired by this Dhamma talk that the king immediately pronounces an amnesty throughout all his kingdom. From now on, nowhere within my kingdom will an animal be slain or killed or maimed. Compassion and harmlessness will be the rule of the day throughout all the kingdom. And so you can see what's happening here, if we understand this right. That moment when that peacock, when that higher masculine figure has given up his fear and has voluntarily and with a sense of goodwill entered into that relationship or made that connection with that feminine figure, both of them are then transformed. And the outcome of that transformation is abundance, is life, is joy. And then the whole kingdom is filled with rejoicing and fertility. And some of the versions of this story, they give, the king grants an amnesty, and later on the deer, in this case the story is golden deer, not golden peacock, and the deer eat the crops of the men. The king complains to the king of the deer, and he makes an arrangement where the men will put a sign on their crops and the deer won't eat the crops. They put a sign there as a sign of a covenant, a covenant between man and nature, where each will respect each other's domain and each will have mutual, live with mutual kindness and mutual respect. And it's in that the peacock or the deer or whatever finds true safety and true security. And now when the peacock returns to his home, he goes back to the same place. He's still living in the forest, in the seclusion, in the isolation. But he's not living there out of fear anymore. He's not living there in the expectation that one day the hunter is going to come. Yeah. So when I found these stories, I found these to be a very beautiful example of how one can learn and what's an appropriate way of learning this kind of relationship with the masculine and the feminine and so on. So it's important to understand that as if it's understood as a developmental model, it doesn't mean that any one of these things is right or wrong. You know, again, I think that idea of the peacock living in seclusion and hiding away from people, it's very much like the Siddhartha, the Bodhisattva, when he was practicing before his enlightenment, isn't it? He said he was practiced the ultimate seclusion. He would run away from people, and he said he had the mind like the mind of a wild deer. And there's obviously a kind of a fearfulness, and it's not necessarily a wrong thing. It may be a very good thing, maybe a very necessary thing for some people in a certain stage of development. But ultimately, then one's going to have to let go of that fear, and one's going to have to learn to understand that higher feminine side. And it's only when that happens that one will transform or truly develop to a higher stage. So I see this as being a very delightful model for how we should think or understand in our life as monastics, in understanding both masculinity and femininity within ourselves, but also with the community as a whole. And I just come back before, just to sum up one more thing before I finish, and just remember at the beginning I said, what is the woman's role? What does she do? You know, this idea of the woman and her desire, this is actually the question which Freud famously said he could never answer. What does a woman want? Yeah. And men have never been able to understand this. What does a woman want? Yeah. But in this story, that woman and her desire, which could be seen as, you know, as irrational, insatiable, you know, wish, in fact, that is the thing that creates the whole story. In fact, it creates the world. That whole world which we've learned about in that story only exists because of that woman's desire. And even though all of the men do the actual action in the story, they only do it because of her. She's the creator of that whole world. She doesn't do anything, but her wish and her yearning actively sustains the whole process. And she's the most important figure in that whole thing. So you can, and the outcome of that wish and that desire is abundance and life. And this, I think, very, very interesting to see that, because that same story could be seen both as a very negative slant on women and their desires, and also as a very positive one, depending on how the story is told and how what your perspective is on the story. So it's very important to remember this when we look at stories that are told in Buddhism. And just one I won't discuss now, but probably the most important one is the ordination story of Mahapajapati. And this is something which can be looked at from so many different angles. And just to remember that the same events could be seen from a very negative angle, but also from a very positive angle, where it's not just her desire in this case is not just for something good, but her desire is in fact a creative and transformative process that sustains the whole action and creates abundance not just for herself but also for the whole realm. So this is my little talk for this evening on spiritual and psychological development, with the idea of the masculine and feminine, and particularly in relation to some of the Jataka stories. So I offer this for your reflection this evening.